Hello and welcome back to another special episode of the Cine Club podcast. I'm Reese.
I'm Billy, and today we're discussing the history and impact of French New Wave cinema. To do this, we're joined by Cine Club veteran and New Wave expert, Dr. Steve Cannon.
Hello.
Hello. So, Steve, would you be able to tell us what French New Wave cinema is for all the uneducated out there and where it got its start?
Well, there's a sort of loose definition, which is that from the late 50s through to the mid-60s, there was a huge generational shift in French cinema. One kind of astonishing statistic is that more than 100 young filmmakers made a debut feature film between 1958 and 1962. And this was immediately following a period of real stagnation after the Second World War, where there were very few new filmmakers. So that in itself, you know, this kind of generational impact. Then there's maybe a tighter definition, which, you know, people argue about. Does it just refer to one particular group of young men who were all critics at the Cahiers du Cinéma, a monthly film magazine, very influential film magazine, both in France and around the world subsequently? You know, seven of them who were all critics and then turned their kind of critical and cinephile sensibilities into filmmaking. So that's a sort of narrower definition. But whichever definition you take, how did it start? You know, what gave it its impetus were two things, I would say. First of all, there was a baby boom, an economic boom, and a boom in cinema attendance. So 1958, 411 million cinema spectators in France. So all of that money was washing around in the film industry. And secondly, it became much easier, much cheaper, much more flexible to make a film. You didn't have to hire a studio for a month. You could get a portable camera, you could get a portable sound recording kit, three or four of your mates, and you could make a film.
Yeah.
And so the money was there. The producers said, well, I'm not risking much giving this young guy a chance to make a film. And lo and behold, you know, Truffaut's first film, Godard's first film, Chabrol's first films made lots of money. Yeah. So it became a bandwagon effect from then on.
Could do with a little bit more of that at the minute as well, rather than these big productions. It would certainly help us out.
Definitely.
So yeah, quite an interesting sort of start to it. Very, very sort of fast and loose, really. With the I feel like it's reflected a lot in the films when you watch them. Like you can tell that they're not, you know, these big, massive, high budget things. But I think that's kind of the appeal of them, really.
Yeah, kind of immediacy. So, you know, they don't always work. You can tell people have slipped up on their lines, but think, oh, hey ho, you know, the energy's there. Mm. The location's great. She looks good, he looks good. Well, you know, who cares if she didn't say the line right or whatever.
Yeah.
So there's a sort of sense of it capturing something about a France that was full of energy and dynamism and much younger as a population. And you know, so in some ways it was the visual accompaniment to the new France that was being born at that time.
Mm. So it's like a proper time capsule of that moment in history. Yeah. I can see that when I've the ones that I've watched, I can definitely see that.
Steve, what is your personal connection to the subject of the New Wave? Like, what does it mean to you?
I mean, I was always interested in the 60s. You know, I guess being born in the 60s, but not old enough to know what I was living through. You know, I found myself, you know, right through late 70s, 80s, you catch a snatch of something on the radio, you know, not famous things like, you know, Beatles songs or whatever, but, you know, little snatches of a sort of novelty pop song, you think, oh, that's familiar. And you don't even know what it is. You know, just that when you were 5, 6, 7 years old, it was kind of there in the atmosphere. I was also really interested in the British New Wave, which I kind of encountered before the French New Wave, partly to sort of see what the world that my parents came from was like, you know, working class, urban, northern Britain. So when I was studying at Wolverhampton Polytechnic, doing a French degree, or essentially a French degree, the people that were teaching me were largely literary interests, but they branched out into film. And so I was there just at the right time. And in terms of my reaction to the New Wave, they brought in a canister of film, you know, this metal box that was brought up by courier from London, from the BFI, the British Film Institute, and it was a 50-minute showreel, a study reel of Jean-Luc Godard. And it was essentially like Jean-Luc Godard's greatest hits album. And we watched the whole thing in class, and I was blown away, basically. So from that, I became really interested in him in particular, the French New Wave in general. I did an undergraduate dissertation on Godard, and then partly by chance, when the MA that I wanted to do in Birmingham didn't run, and they said, why don't you do a PhD instead? It just seemed obvious to kind of carry on with Godard. So as I've probably bored people with over the years, you sicken yourself with someone that you think you love when you spend 5+ years working on them.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was my kind of personal investment in it. I really did become, you know, kind of obsessed with Godard in particular and the New Wave in general.
You can definitely see sort of the influence Godard had, and obviously we've experienced a bit of it when it's been on the modules. So, I can't say I'm his biggest fan, but personally, I leaned more towards the Left Bank stuff that was shown. I quite liked Cleo from 5 to 7. I quite liked Umbrellas of Cherbourg, so on. I just felt like, I don't know, I feel like with some of the Godard stuff, particularly I think it was Tout va bien, felt way too much, like way too self-indulgent. Yeah. It was more or less just actors looking directly into the camera, saying his ideology, like with no real nuance to it. That's how I sort of read it anyway. That's not to say like I didn't like any of his films. They've all got the merit to them. Like, I wasn't the biggest fan of Alphaville, but I could definitely appreciate the style and how much stuff like Blade Runner or whatever have taken from that, even if it was just sort of a load of techno nonsense in the dialogue.
No, I can understand that and appreciate it. I mean, I don't champion Godard the way that lots of film critics and other people who'd written about him at the time I was doing the PhD had done. Mm. In fact, I became, you know, known as, when I would go to conferences about Godard, as I was the negative one, I was the critic. And precisely, you know, that kind of hectoring style, if you like, where the politics come to the fore, you know, he kind of lost what I was talking about earlier, you know, that kind of sense of a finger on the pulse.
Yeah.
And capturing a really exciting moment in France. And, you know, something I always love, you know, at the same time, the clothes, the music and the cafes and the cars, you know, by the time he comes to that sort of political phase after May 68 and into the 70s, you know, that kind of almost sense of his own wonder at how France is changing and, you know, a love-hate relationship with it, but an engagement with it, you know, he becomes much, much more dogmatic.
Mm, yeah, definitely. There is like a very clear shift from the early ones that I've seen then to the later ones. So that makes a lot of sense. You got anything?
Yeah, I think I completely agree with what you're saying. I think Godard, he does capture France as it was in the 60s. And I think that's one of the most interesting things about him. Like no other film has, like, or like genre does this, or no other like movement does this, in that it puts you so in connection with the people of the time. And like the city, like Paris itself is its own, like its own world in itself in these films. And I absolutely adore that about them. Like the amount of different places you'll see, like it's rare that you'll see like a overhead shot or anything like that. It's always like from the ground level. You really can't
put
yourself there. Yeah. And with the 60s being such a time of happening, of everything happening, basically all these new movements, the things that like essentially made the world the way they are now happening back then, it is just such an eye opener to see. And it really, like, I wouldn't say it carries the films, but I would say it's certainly like a big appealing part of it.
I think the visual, you could argue that the visuals, like going back to Alphaville, I think the visuals carry a lot with that film, with the sort of noir influences and so on. But yeah, a lot of them, I like them for their authenticity. Mm. It's they feel grounded. They feel like, it's as if, obviously it's fictional, but it's as if you've just stuck a camera in like a real person's house and you're just following them around, which a lot of them are like that. So you do sort of get the sense sometimes that like you've seen one, you've seen them all, but then you get that one little bit in it that sort of twists it and makes it unique. And I think that's why I kept going back to them.
Yeah, exactly. Like there's always this one bit where you're like, oh my God, that's so different. It's so interesting. Mm. All of them are like immensely personal as well to the directors, to the creators.
Yeah.
And it's good learning a facet of someone's character through a film, but there are also, because they're so personal to the directors, there's like some that you relate to yourself as well, and that end up being like everyone's like your personal favourites, and like for different reasons.
I think you're right in that, like, the sort of, I've never really felt when I've watched film as much as I do when I've seen the sort of French New Wave and adjacent ones of that, that you can feel the director in the film. So like you can tell it's a Godard film, you can tell it's an Agnès Varda film, you can tell it's a Jacques Demy film, and so on. They've all got their own distinct personalities, so it doesn't really work if you like lump them all in as one thing, because they've all got their own unique voice.
I mean, both Varda and Godard regularly spoke in their own films, even if they didn't physically appear. And they also kind of mutually appeared in each other's films. So in Cléo de Sacasset, you know, Godard and his then wife, Anna Karina, you know, play a little silent film sequence on the riverbank and so on. So, you know, they were all that generation knocked about together and shared ideas and, you know, did favours for each other, helped each other out, you know, in all sorts of ways. But that kind of sense of it capturing a city in flux, you know, is partly accidental. They couldn't afford to hire studios, so they couldn't make costume dramas. They couldn't, you know, adapt literary classics. But they also kind of didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
So what did they do? They said, oh, there's a nice cafe down there. The guy behind the bar will let us film in there. If we go in at, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning, there's nobody in. Mm-hmm. So they just, you know, it's guerrilla filmmaking, they would call it nowadays. You know, they occupied spaces that were available to them, the streets, cafes that they knew, hotels that they could rent rooms by the hour.
Yeah.
And their own apartments, you know. They so when you say it's like being in somebody's real house, it often was.
Yeah. Yeah, that definitely added to it. Leading on from that, are there any sort of favourites or least favourite films or moments for you?
Well, like I say, the showreel, which completely misled me about Jean-Luc Godard's filmmaking. Oh, if it's all like this, this is the greatest filmmaker who's ever lived. But sadly, it wasn't all like that. So, you know, those moments like the dance sequence in Band Apart, you know, which inspired Tarantino, you know, both to name his production company after it and to show John Travolta and Uma Thurman that before they did the dance in Jackrabbit Slims in Pulp Fiction. You know, it's just such a living, breathing moment. You know, it's a real cafe. You know, they are actors. There is a script, but he gets them to just act around it.
Mm-hmm.
He's shown them the dance steps. The dance steps are there on the jukebox from which the sound is coming. And then he adds in his own voice and just sort of comments on it. And it's, you know, it can annoy some people. Why doesn't he just let the music play? But, you know, it's so full of ideas.
Yeah.
So full of life. Whereas other parts of that film drag, you know, they really do.
Yeah.
So, you know, that greatest hits compilation is the greatest Godard film of the 60s. But to give him his due, he made so many films. He made so many films so quickly. And this was true of all of them. And they were just constantly coming up with ideas. And, you know, by the time they were editing that one, they were already thinking about the next one. So, you know, maybe they did, you know, botch some of it or rush some of it or think, oh, I can't be bothered with that anymore. Let's just release it. And it was so cheap to make. They always had the resources to make another one.
Yeah, I was going to say, hell of a work ethic.
So do you think like the bits that you might say is boring or like, I wouldn't say failure, but like less interesting parts of the film, do you think that like is part of the appeal of the New Wave, with them being so experimental and being so out there, that like being able to see a bit that kind of didn't work, but you can see what they were doing, what they were trying to do, as well as in the same film as something great.
Yeah.
Do you think that's part of the appeal?
Yeah, in the sense that you can try anything, you can throw all sorts of ideas into a film. It doesn't just have to be a sort of rigid interpretation of a pre-existing script. That if the actor does something, if the actor sneezes, if a song comes on the jukebox, yeah, let's leave that in. But also those moments of nothing happening, you know, at the very least, you know, you're looking at actors. Sometimes you can tell they're feeling uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Is he not supposed to whisper me a next line? And I mean, you know, without you know, this isn't just a personal view, it's a very widely shared one. You get to look at Anna Karina saying doing nothing.
Yeah.
So there's always that.
Yeah. Mm. Worth it alone fair to watch Anna Karina in them.
So I think part of what interests me about it, and like it's something I've really tried to work out when I'm watching these films, is what I like so much about them. because in retrospect, they are like seen as some of the greatest films of all time, the greatest movement in film history. But if I didn't know that, and if I didn't have that reverence for it going in, I don't know whether I'd like them as much.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a strange feeling, because with all these shots of, like, especially the shots of nothing happening, in retrospect, because this is like, they're treated as such artistic masterpieces, I feel like I read into it more and I start thinking, oh, what does he mean by this? What does God mean, linger on the shot too long? Is it like some artistic thing I'm just too stupid to get?
So it makes you conscious of what you're watching and therefore think about it differently,
Uh-huh. But is there anything to think about though? Am I like looking too far into it? Is God really that smart that in retrospect it still applies like so many years later?
So you're approaching it more like as an academic text rather than... Like,
yeah, exactly. It's something to read instead of something to take in. Mm. Like... watching Breathless, there's bits, like, again, it's just like shots of France, it's just shots of Paris.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, this is great, this is amazing, this is the best thing I've ever seen. I don't know why it is though. Is it just because it's Paris in that time? I think that's part of what it is, the appeal of, like, again, being so close to a different time. And then you have those very improvised moments matched with like very, very, very constructed moments that are just so good. There's the bit in Breathless, I think, where she's interviewing this guy, and the shots, first off, are just great. But he says this line, I want to become immortal and then die, which is a crazy thing to say. and then the scene just kind of ends on that, and like she thinks about that for the rest. I don't know how it affects the rest of the film. I can't say it as like a through line throughout it, because in the way a film's like structured, something like that, a line like that would have a big impact, and you'd be able to like track it as a theme throughout the film, but I just can't.
When she's interviewing the film director?
I think it's the film director,
So, I mean, obviously there's the sort of self-consciousness of Godard bringing one of his favourite filmmakers onto set and getting him to do a turn. And I suppose it's relevant to the end of the film, spoiler alert, you know, does he die and become immortal at the same time, you know?
That's what I was thinking. Does he die in that film? I really couldn't tell if that was him dying or not. But yeah, that Breathless is a great one.
Yeah.
I think if I had to label my sort of favourite from that period, it would probably be Hiroshima Mon Amour. I just thought that was really, really good. Not sure what it was that sort of grabbed us so much about it, but I just thought it was amazing. Just really, like, a great period piece, a great drama. I think it was the fact that it was taken out of the usual sort of bubble of what you would expect from these new wave left bank films in terms of setting and, you know, stuff like that. And it just felt quite different.
Yeah. No, it's an amazing film. I mean, it's, you know, it's quite difficult to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly it must have confused the hell out of spectators at that time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the argument is that the left bank, which is, you know, Agnès Varda, Jean Rouch, Jacques Demy to some extent, and René, that they were more serious, less simply cinephiles, you know, playing with the medium, and more, you know, more political or more analytical.
Yeah.
And, you know, what that film does is it brings what the experiments in French novels at the time were, you know, stream of consciousness and, you know, kind of automatic syndromes of memory and, you know, and brings them to the screen in really interesting and compelling visual ways. The other thing about it, of course, is that in the midst of a film about Hiroshima, you know, which is apparently not about France, you know, her memories of falling in love with a German soldier during the occupation, you know, to do that in 1958-59 was really, really bold. And, you know, the first serious film to do so.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, that's the thing about the new wave. It's not just messing about.
Very boundary pushing.
Yeah.
Mm. I kind of thought the same about Umbrellas of Cherbourg. That was quite boundary pushing technically. The fact that basically every single thing it said in the film is sung rather than spoken compared to most musicals from the time. Like, you know, if you go and watch a musical on stage now, there will be a lot of sort of sing talking, for lack of a better word. But I feel like at the time that was quite unusual. I know that can be like a bit of a grating style for some people. I know a lot of the people who watched it as well didn't really enjoy it, but I thought it was really good.
I was not the biggest fan of that film. I like what he was trying to do. I love the colours, I love the commentary on the change in nature of life in France. But oh my God, I couldn't get behind it. I think it's because I don't speak French. I don't understand the language, so it doesn't really like resonate with us in the way they're singing it.
The that was a film I came to very late, you know, teaching the module that you both did. And Lewis Harley, name check, who did the module a few years ago and was a Cine Club regular, he picked that film, and that was the film we did for the festival. So, you know, I came at it completely fresh, had to read everything I could find about it, and it's really, really interesting, the analysis of it, both then and now. And it, you know, it's just, it's a kind of one-off, you know, there's no other New Wave musicals. God are messed about with the idea of a musical with a Woman is a Woman.
I've seen that one.
And it's, you know, the Hollywood studios had stopped making musicals at that time. And in some ways he, you know, he kind of brought it back to life, you know, a homage to it, but also a kind of critique of it, or an updating of it,
I quite liked in that A Woman is a Woman, how sort of that also felt quite boundary pushing, because like they were literally turning to the camera and speaking to the audience and stuff like that. It was like fourth wall breaking before that was a commonplace thing.
And obviously that then leads to what you were talking about earlier, that by the 70s, these political speeches to camera, Godard kind of develops that technique into, what becomes a sort of dogmatic process rather than just a playing with the medium.
Like a tongue-in-cheek playing, Speaking of the festival, it's not really a friend, it's not really New Wave, but one of my other favourites was Eyes Without a Face, which I did for the festival. It's similar sort of time period, but it's not really included with the movement, but I just thought it was worth giving a mention to, because I think it's quite good. It's unusual, like sort of French horror film, but it's good. It's weird, but it's good. I liked it.
Yeah, all the boundaries were pushed back then.
They really were.
That's probably part of what makes it so fun, seeing that this was probably the first time. Like the fourth wall breaks, like you mentioned, like direct address from the director, someone who was needing a character in the film, or even if they are a character in the film. Their address from someone just didn't happen before that point. And that's crazy. As an audience member, seeing that for the first time, you would go crazy. It just didn't happen. It wasn't something that people had thought could happen. Pushed the boundaries of what cinema was as a conversation, as a way for the creator to communicate with an audience.
I mean, I can appreciate what you were saying, Reese, that, you know, there's a sort of weight hangs over these films, you know, that these are landmarks. And, you know, let's be honest, critics and theorists hugely exaggerated how good or how groundbreaking or how spectacularly different some of the techniques are or were. I mean, Godard is praised for having invented the jump cut in Breathless. Well, he didn't, because jump cuts existed before. And what did he do? Oh, he didn't know how to edit all of these amazing sequences he had, so he just got the bits that he liked and stuck them together. That's what the jump cut was. He didn't know how to edit his film. So, you know, giving that a value beyond, you know, yes, improvisation, yes, you know, learning the technique as you go along, you know, it is part of what's dogged the French New Wave. But you do have to say, and there's a book which has this as its title, you know, revolution, you know, world cinema is revolutionized by the French New Wave. You wouldn't have Spielberg, you wouldn't have Scorsese, you wouldn't have Coppola. You know, they watched those films at their film school, you know, along with Italian neorealism and Soviet montage cinema and whatever. But the sense of kind of verve and inventiveness that the French New Wave showed could be done, even in a genre film, even in a documentary, you know, anywhere and everywhere you can do new things with cinema. You know, I think people like Coppola and Scorsese, you know, thought, "All right, great," and you know, gave them the nod or gave them the support, if you like, to put themselves on screen and to put their own stories on screen.
Like if Godard can, like you say, do those jump cuts, which when I was watching it, I was thinking, "Oh, was that meant to happen? Was he meant to like just have?" Because you can see it when, like, if it's meant to be like a static shot, that it just like kind of shifts to the left a bit because like someone's not the camera or something, and it's annoying in a way. Because that would never happen now. You would never, ever get, like, that seems like a flaw. But seeing that, like, rawness really, like, it adds to the mystique, I think.
Yeah.
And, like, the improvisation and the rawness adds to it.
The only modern examples I can think of are where a filmmaker's trying to suggest that something is being, you know, misremembered or extremely subjectively rendered. And so therefore you get flaws in the editing to suggest, oh, you know, this is in his head and not, which, you know, that can be quite effective. But, but yeah, no, I think raw, you know, they had raw energy. They had a rawness about their talent, about their ideas. And therefore, as I say, lots of those films, particularly Godard's, because he made so many of them, you know, are not finished, polished, honed products. You know, they're works in the making, and sometimes they just end abruptly, you know, usually with the central character being killed because he can't think of any other way to do it.
That was Viva Savi, wasn't it? Where she just gets gunned down in the street and that's the end of it.
Yeah.
There's not even a last word in that film, is it? She just gets shot and then it's Finn.
That's the end of it.
That's great. Thanks, Godard. Like, he, in Breathless as well, he uses these little, like, transitions. Like, you know what they do in Star Wars with, like, the circle that slowly goes in. He does that, like, Looney Tunes style at some point. he does it, like, twice. I'm thinking, what the hell is he doing that for? Like, it doesn't match with the tone or the new waviness of anything else.
Doesn't someone get blown up at the end of Pierre Le Fou?
Yep.
That's how that one ends, I think.
Jean-Paul Belmondo.
Yeah, he just...
Another spectacular death.
paints himself blue and then blows himself up with some dynamite on an island.
He wraps the dynamite around his head. And then you cut to an extreme long shot.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Oh, God, that's funny.
I know, it completely took me... I think that was probably one of the first Godard films I actually watched, on my own, that I went and sought out, and it definitely took us by surprise for it to end like that. But I think that's quite a good, like, sort of overall sentiment. It's avant-garde, it's unusual, it's surprising as a movement, like, on the whole, and like you were saying before, you can't really understate how much of an impact it's had on cinema all around the world. And Even CineClub wouldn't have CineClub without French New Wave.
Yeah, I mean it's a particular kind of French understanding of and celebration of cinema. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that one should seek out things from the past and one should dig up things that people might not like and might not always want to watch and make sure you discuss them afterwards, because, you know, nobody's opinion on it is any more valid than anyone else's. So we carry on that tradition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the discussion's what makes it, really. Like, a question I wanted to ask, though, was how well do you think the new wave would go down now to a modern audience, who, like, the average viewer now? Like, if I showed this to, like, say, my mum and dad, shout out to them for listening, by the way. Hi. if I showed them that, like, any film from the new wave, how would they respond, do you think?
I do remember watching a couple of Godard films with my dad, because he wanted to know what I was spending all my time on. And yeah, I mean, he had to force himself, let's be clear. But having said that, there was a whole series of Godard. Well, first they did Truffaut and then they did Godard on BBC Two.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Channel 4 launched in 83, 84, there was then a complete retrospective of Godard, including all the obscure things that no one else had seen. And so, you know, it was mainstream and it was mainstreamed at that time. It wasn't something you had to hunt down. But yeah, I mean, it's of a cinephile sensibility, and it doesn't mean you have to have a degree to get it or have a degree to like it. But, you know, there's a sort of element of kind of cinephile awareness in how they make the films that perhaps is a barrier to general, you know, kind of casual watching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like what we have now, let's say like Marvel films and that's not what was being put out then. It's not what, like, it's nothing close. Like it's like night and day. Seriously, the difference is insane. And I've seen people who've, like, said, oh, I don't watch films made before 2010. I'm thinking, what the hell are you doing?
People are weird. They, like, refuse to watch black and white films, refuse to watch subtitles. Like, just, if these people sort of broaden their horizons a little bit, I think they'd surprise themselves. And, like, with these, there's always been, like, a sort of stigma, I feel, around French cinema as being, like, pretentious and so on. But, like, I broaden my horizons and watch them and, like, It's great. Mm-hmm. There's a few stinkers in there, yeah. But there's a few great ones there as well. If you know where to look.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's something that needs easing into a bit, though. Mm. Like going straight from, like, say, mainstream films now to any of the new wave films is a bit. It's very jarring. But if you do, like, even like read an article about it or something like that, literally just like a review, and like get to understand why, like a bit of the history behind it, why it's so revered. That's what would get you into it, I feel.
Yeah,
that's what would like make you understand why it's so loved, why it's so like praised.
I mean, if we bring it up to the contemporary, obviously, you know, Godard and Varda both lived into their 90s and were still making films right till the end. So, you know, some of their ideas never went away. But, you know, there have been attempts to kind of bring back the sensibility of the French New Wave, the Dogma 95 movement that Lars von Trier and Thomas Vinterberg and others launched. You know, interesting, but kind of strangely self-limiting, I suppose.
Mm.
You might say that the French New Wave filmmakers limited themselves by not, you know, making lush, you know, CinemaScope films that for which the technology was available. But to say in an era of, you know, accessible and relatively cheap, decent filmmaking technology, that you're going to only make it on video, you know, it struck me as odd at the time. And one or two of the films are really interesting, but others, you know, suffer from their limitations. So that didn't last long. But I mean, a British filmmaker who does slightly quirky things, whose second film I saw at the Tyneside the other week, The Rose of Nevada. I've forgotten the filmmaker's name, which is terrible. But he uses a kind of clockwork hand cranked camera.
Oh wow.
So each shot is a restricted length of how long the piece of film is. Yeah, I don't know, it's something like 30 seconds or something. And it creates this kind of almost otherworldly. So it's a very kind of everyday film in some ways, a fishing village, a ship, a trawler going out to sea. And you get kind of shots lasting, you know, this single take that the little camera can do, you know, of the kind of rusted metal on the side of the boat, or, you know, some rocks with moss on in the harbour.
Mm.
And you just end up feeling this is a strange version of reality. And because the film is slightly supernatural in ways that, you know, aren't really explained, but you certainly come to experience, you know, in some ways the visuals really match what the themes are. And so I find that really interesting that you could make, I'm not saying it was cheap because he must have had, and he had good actors in it, the next James Bond apparently and all that. But it was really, really interesting to see someone do something, you know, not experimental for its own sake, but a different way of treating a subject and a different way of filming it, which, and that was just, you know, a film made this year kind of thing.
Yeah, the recent Nouvelle Vogue, Richard Linklater like sort of biopic about those early days.
Yeah, about the making of, you know, it kind of gives you a bit of context of the French New Wave, and then it's mainly day to day, you know, Godard wandering around smoking and everyone else saying, what the hell's he doing now? Especially the producer who's paying for it. I must admit, by the end of the film, you know, I loved it and I thought it was really, really well made. But by the end of the film, I felt they, again, were giving Godard credit for a sort of coherent vision of the world, if you like.
Mm, which just wasn't really the case.
Yeah, so this idea that, you know, the jump cut thing, you know, they kind of suggest that was done on purpose, and you know, I kind of know that it wasn't.
Yeah.
So, you know, that over-egging or overvaluing of the French New Wave, and particularly of Godard, you know, does still pertain even in, well, I mean, it's a homage to him, so you would expect it.
Yeah. You got anything else to say?
I do, yes. About some films that are my favourites that I haven't mentioned. We have mentioned Agnes Varda. I did an essay on her, I think it was this year, and that really, like, got me to, like, kind of get her films and understand them, because this is, again, something like, very personal about the New Wave, and, like, how every film is, like, a product of its director more so than any other movement, really, that Varda, in her history as a photographer, makes her films so much more interesting just by, like, implementing that into them. Like, in Cleo, how, like, you can treat every, like, these like certain shots as like compositions, like there would be like a classical portrait or just a very good bit of photography that like is a snapshot into her changing mental state and her changing like worldview at that point in the film. And I just adore it for that. I think it's one of my favourites. Oh my God, what's it called? Her first one. Oh, I forgot the name. No, I forgot the name of it.
The Fishing Village.
Fishing Village.
La Pointe Courte.
Thank you, La Pointe Courte. Yeah. I like that one not as much, but for being like one of the first New Wave films made, oh my God. Like, it's like watching history be made in front of you. With being such a guerrilla production, being just mostly, well, people that, like, she knew people that, like, had to be followed up 25 years later to get their full paycheck, which is, again, like, another weird aspect of the guerrilla filmmaking. I feel like the more background knowledge you know and the more, like, you look into it, I feel like the more personally attached you can get to these films. And, the more you read about them, the more you get to understand them, because watching them with no guidance, sort of, having no clue about them, about what makes them so good, and just thinking, this is good, why am I supposed to see that this is good, what's so good about it? You don't really get that, but if you do some reading beforehand, if you like do some just like appreciation of it, then it becomes a completely different experience, I feel. Especially on a second watch, if you watch them like twice, then you can be like, oh my God, I didn't miss that the first time, that links back to this later on, that was because of this, da 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 da, and it's just brilliant. I love it.
I mean, Agnès Varda, as I said, lived on into her 90s and was still making really, really interesting films, partly drawing on her background in photography. So she did one called Faces Places, I think it was called in English, Visage Village in French, where she travels around France with a documentary photographer and they meet interesting people, film them, and then he takes a static shot portrait of them and they essentially blow that up and put it on the gable end of houses so that you then see these people in their own town, you know, a waitress in a cafe or some guy who cleans the streets, and then, you know, their whole body or their head on the end of an apartment building or something. And it's just such a brilliant idea. But my favourite of her later films, and one that shows, you know, maybe that I could slightly disagree with you, that, you know, you don't have to approach it with a cinematic sensibility, is a documentary she made, and I think it was shown on French TV, called The Gleaners and I. And it was made about 2000 or late 90s, about people living on the margins of society and gleaning, the idea that you go into the field after the combine harvesters have been and you can glean what's left and it's free. You know, this is a sort of long-standing tradition of agricultural life. And so, you know, she films these guys, you know, alcoholics living in a caravan, and they're parked up on the edge of a potato field, and then when the harvest is gone, all the other potatoes are left, and that's how they live. And then she finds other people doing that in cities, you know, picking up lettuce leaves after the market's closed, and just it develops a sort of portrait of some people who've chosen to live like that, some people who are forced to live like that. And it's just really human and really engaging. And she's in it as herself and filming herself and her aging process and commenting on what she thinks about the state of the world. And it's just really, really charming and really warm. And there was so much, you know, kind of pleasure people got from that on French TV that they demanded she make a sequel and go back and find them again. And, you know, surprise, surprise, one or two of them had died, you know, because they weren't living a healthy and happy life. But, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, really communicating, engaging with French society, but being able to visually represent it, you know, I just think that's a real gift. And it did, you know, communicate beyond a sort of overtly cinephile market, if you like.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah, that actually sounds really good. I want to watch that now. Mm-hmm.
The documentary side needs to be appreciated a bit more, I think, because most people focus on the fiction side, because the documentary, it blends, you know, because they're not really extras in the films. They're just people who are walking around France who just happen to be in the shot. So that is like part of the snapshot moment of it. So when they intentionally make it a snapshot, the possibilities are endless.
No, it's always fascinating, that crossover, yeah.
I think that's all the French auteurs we've got time for today. Make sure to check out our Instagram, TikTok and Facebook pages for more CineClub podcast content and updates. As always, this episode was recorded and produced by us, the Sunderland University students, as well as being engineered and edited by Emily Main. A special thanks goes out to Steve for joining us.
No problem. Enjoyed it a great deal.
As well as Barbara Sadler and Richard Berry. A reminder that our two Cahiers du Cinéma critics this week have consisted of me, Billy,
and me, Reese. This has been a Cinéclub production for Spark. Thanks for listening.